Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 406. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are John Lindemann.
I'm back again.
Guillaume Veillette.
Sure, I'll stop playing Fantasy Life for 2 hours.
Please. And James Jones.
Sure, I'll stop playing Fantasy Life for 2 weeks.
A tale of two gamers. Anyway, we're not going to talk about Fantasy Life, as far as I know, on this episode. We've had a good bit of that lately. Instead, we are going to get to some listener mail. We're going to catch up on a few things, including a couple that I had queued up for the telethon that we didn't have time for, and a few that we had queued up for last week that we didn't have time for, and then we'll see. But first up is new business, and James is going to kick it off this week.
Sure.
By the way, I should warn people before we get started, we're recording this literally like 3 hours before Smash Brothers is released for digital purchase, and so we have not played it yet.
No.
Next week.
In fact, we are just going to forego playing it as a charity movement for people who can't play Smash Brothers.
Yep. We call it Destination.
Jesus Christ.
I'm going to forego playing it until Nintendo sends the unlock patch to my
system. We're going to call it the No Items Charity.
No
for
Smash Brothers.
No Items Charity for people who can't play Smash Brothers good. But in lieu of this great sacrifice that we are making, this American hero sacrifice we are making, I have decided to spend some time with my 3DS because it's been somewhat neglected. I'm still playing Hyrule Warriors. I started playing Bayo, but I don't really have to talk about on either of those. So went back to the 3DS eShop library specifically. First off, we're going to talk about our friend Seren's game, I Gotta Run Complete Edition, I think it's the full name for the 3DS version.
Uh-huh.
Yep. So she graciously sent each of us codes to play this game. This is a port, and well, it's not a port. It's an enhanced port of the Wii U game that came out about 3 or 4 months ago. Adds some new gameplay styles. Adds 3D, obviously. Adds some character unlocks. It's an endless runner game. Basically, the idea of this game is the game just starts as soon as you turn it on, which is kind of a neat way to handle an endless runner. It's very, it's a pick up and play experience. I mean, you basically every button jumps, and you just keep going as long as you can.
Mm-hmm.
It works. It works well. It's kind of a mindless fun game that I played a little bit while we were doing the telethon. I've enjoyed it. Like I said, I mean, it's an endless runner, so I mean, you know, there's not much I can say about it.
It does feel like the complete game, whereas the Wii U version seemed kind of like practice. Because for now, at least the background actually scrolls.
Sure.
Which it did not in the Wii U version. And you can play with the camera angle as well. You can have the camera tilt a little bit behind you, which is pretty cool.
I think the 3D actually works pretty well.
It looks nice.
It's a very well done port of this game. So if you didn't play the original and you like endless runners, I mean, it's not a bad choice. And it's fairly cheap.
I think the physics feel a little bit better in the 3DS game.
Yeah, there's something feels a little bit better about it, but I couldn't really put my finger on what it was.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I think it has something to do with the jumping trajectory or something like that. But I like this one more. I mean, it costs more. I think it's $5, but it also has a lot more content.
Stuff. Yeah.
I've had a good time with it. You know, appreciate her sending us copies of that.
Yeah, much thanks.
It's a nice thing to have, like, on your system, downloaded. You know, it's just, you said, if you have not enough time to boot up your Fire Emblem or Smash Brothers, or I mean, you can play a whole game of I've Got to Run in the time it takes Smash Brothers to load.
Oh, yeah. And like I said, literally, you start the game and it's going. Like, there's no menu. It just goes. You have to pause the game to change your mode.
Even when you die, it just immediately starts over again. So,
yeah.
It's a good interface. I like it.
Yep. So moving on to the game that I'm going to talk a bit more about, because I didn't really have enough time to talk about, time under the belt to talk about the other games, or in the case of Hyrule Warriors, I pretty much said my fill on it. I went ahead and browsed through the eShop, and we've had this before. It's led to things like non-baseball games from the NES that are not RBI baseball, and other such wonderful experiences. And today, I went through the relatively new releases. I think this was last week's release. And stumbled across Pokemon the Trading Card Game for the Game Boy Color on the 3DS eShop Virtual Console, which is a lot of nouns in one sentence.
A lot of colons.
Yeah. So I remember when this game came out. It was, I want to say it was between red, blue, and gold, silver. But at that time, it was roughly concurrent with gold, silver. At that time, the Pokemon Trading Card Game was stupid. I mean, it was, stores would have signs up that says, "We do not have any cards." And you just think, what the fuck?
Yeah, who's buying these?
What, John, really?
Oh, I think I know who.
Children are buying these, John.
No, it's cartels, Panamanian cartels.
It's true.
I'm going to guess that none of us ever really played with the physical cards.
So I was probably just a little too old. So I knew people who did. Because I was probably, what would that be? It'd be like 98? 99?
Well, when this game came out, I think it was about, yeah, I mean, when the trading card game first made it big would have been 98, 99, 2000. And then yeah. I think the Game Boy Color version probably came out in 2000.
Yeah, not too big at my college.
Yeah. But
I had a lot of friends in high school whose younger siblings were way into it, and they would show me the cards, and I'd be like, oh, I actually know these characters because I play the video game, but I have no interest in playing your watered-down, shitty version of Magic the Gathering.
So conversely, I was like 13, so I mean, I knew people who actually did play it. Mm-hmm. But you know, mostly it was younger siblings who were, you know, the age gap wasn't so much that interacting with your friend's younger siblings would be weird. You know, there's like 3 or 4 years you can kind of get away with it. And then after that, it's just kind of like, I don't want to talk to you. I have anything in common with you. So I did have some, you know, I mean, I saw the game and I just remember thinking, yeah, this is just Magic the Gathering. Okay, great.
It's very similar, and it is designed by the same guy, Richard Garfield, and
yep.
And published by the same company. So it is very similar, and for me, that's the main reason I never played it. I was like, well, I've got $1,000 worth of Magic the Gathering cards. I really don't need to get into a different, similar game. You know?
Right, and that had gone through its fad a few years earlier. Mm-hmm. So this was sort of the combination of two things that had fads back in like 96, 97. And it turned into just a ridiculous selling spree of just, I mean, you'd walk into GameSpot and they would have, or at that time it would have been like Software, etc. And they had just had a whole wall that was just covered in empty display boxes of Pokemon trading card games. And it's like, why are we here right now? But this game came out relatively hot on the heels of the card craze, which leads me to believe it wasn't a response. It was something they were making. And it is it's a very strange thing. It is, I'm not sure Pokemon exists in this world. I don't think they actually do. I think this is an understanding that the Pokemon are fiction, although there's no narrative history of where they come from. It's just a trading card game people play as opposed to, you know, dogfighting with various superpowered animals.
So this is set on Earth.
Maybe? I don't know. I mean, Pokemon's weird.
It's a simulacrum of the real world.
Yeah, something along
that. Whereas Pokemon is very much not on Earth, right? It's in...
Yeah.
It's in a different universe where these monsters coexist with people and they have like this whole weird culture where Pokemon are basically the only thing that any person ever talks about.
Right. And in this case, all anybody talks about are cards with pictures of Pokemon on them.
Of course. Well, for a lot of kids, that was probably very much like the real world.
which is, to have a mild diversion for a moment here, not that we haven't had one for this entire conversation thus far, but in the Pokemon world, the only animals that exist are Pokemon. In this world, there are no Pokemon, which means in this world, there are no animals.
Mm.
So this is a world where mankind has made itself the dominant predator by force. And then has commemorated its victories on playing cards. I don't know. This is a weird fucking
very,
game.
His Dark Materials trilogy stuff.
This is a real fucking weird game, if you haven't figured that out already. So... Mm. Basically, I mean, there was kind of a run of these. I mean, I think we had on the site a designated Yu-Gi-Oh! Reviewer at one point. Just
yep. Because there was only one person on staff who actually understood how to play Yu-Gi-Oh!
And Yu-Gi-Oh! Is fucking nuts compared to Pokemon.
It's impenetrable is probably the word I would use. I think Pokemon is probably a lot easier to learn.
Absolutely. But There were a rush of these card battle things turned into video games, and this one in particular is interesting in that the opening tutorial you get for how to play a Pokemon the trading card game is, open the game manual, and I'm like, oh no. Oh, this is going to go badly. Because I have the 3DS. I don't have the game manual. I have a digital thing I can't have open while I'm watching the game talk to me about how to play the game, so that's fun. The first battle, it just tells you exactly what to do for every turn. So you don't feel like you're learning anything. It's just, you know, you play a card with a base monster, and then each turn you can put an energy type on it, and then their attacks that are available are based on what energy you've put down on them. You can only put down one energy per turn, which really makes things super fucking slow. You can evolve them if you get the card to evolve them. I mean, it is magic, but it's slowed down in that you can't do a bunch of things at one time. So you're constantly sort of building your next Pokemon when you have downtime. It's, you know, it's just a bunch of just real basic strategy to manage. And for the first hour of this game, I was just getting my shit wrecked constantly. Now, I was abusing the crap out of the 3DS save state system because I didn't want to deal with this crap. But I did eventually start building decks, because basically the premise of this game is you go from, they don't call them gyms, they call them card battle arenas. You go through eight of them,
a literal
hey,
of them,
and get badges to go play the elite four elite Pokemon card players. It's like, wow, you guys just fucking went after it, didn't you? But there's no overworld. You just bounce between these non-gyms and talk to people and fight people, and then eventually, I guess, you get to challenge the non-gym leaders. It's sort of a meta view of what the Pokemon games are. I mean, there's none of the overworld exploration. There's no villainous, incompetent, dastardly, stupid criminal organization that is foiled by small children.
I'm just sad to hear that. So
what they do?
I don't know. What do they do in Pokemon games?
Well, I mean,
none
to be
of it
fair,
makes any
if,
sense.
Look, if I had a fucking Onix, I could pretty much wreck house wherever I wanted. I mean, so, yeah, I mean, a card version of that's not quite so intimidating as a two-ton giant rock snake. So, the game itself is just, it's just battles at one or after another. When you win, you get booster sets, and you just keep building your deck, and I guess this is addictive if you really get this game. I didn't win until, like, my fifth or sixth game and really tried to figure out what it was. But, yeah, this game, if you think games over-tutorialize, this, like I said, this game just tells you to consult the manual. So, here you go. This is your chance to go see what life was like before we had real proper tutorialization. There is a dude at the start who's like, I'll answer all your questions. And you just get all these topics you can ask questions about, but you've never played the game before. So, you don't even know what the questions he's asking you about are. This game is just nuts. I mean, I might keep playing it just for laughs, because this has been a real experience, but people really have fond memories of this game. I'm like, people were excited when this game got announced.
They were probably very young.
Yeah, well, they had to be.
Well, there's a lot of advantages to the video game version of the card game, because you get all the cards at the time, I guess, all the cards that existed
right.
were built into this for one flat rate, and the flat rate in 2014 is a lot less than it was in 2000 even. So,
sure.
You know, for your $5 for your Game Boy Color game, you get all these Pokemon cards and you can make decks. And I'm guessing if it's like Magic Online, one of the great advantages is that you can make multiple decks that contain the same cards. Whereas with physical cards, obviously you have to move cards
so
back and forth across decks to play different ones.
About
that's
that.
Annoying. Yeah.
I think you do have to move them across decks.
Ugh.
I know. That was the best part. So I went to make a second deck just to deal with this rock place, and it's all of my grass types are zero out of however many I had because they're all in the other deck. It's like,
oh, that's not good.
It's like, who the fuck cares? What the fuck are you
interface.
Doing?
Still, I know there is a lot of nostalgia for this game. I always was curious to try it. It seemed like a very low cost, easy way to try that trading card game. And Evan Birchfield, the co-founder of this podcast, has often told me that it was one of his favorite games.
I mean, if
now,
you get...
Evan's 5 years younger than me, so he might have been more in the demographic at the time. But still, you know, in 2000, he was a teenager. And you know, he has pretty good taste. So I've always meant to try it, and I might still try it on 3DS.
It's, like I said, it's $5. I mean, it's not like you're gonna break the bank playing it, but it's, I mean, it is Pokemon the trading card game as the Game Boy Color could represent at the best of its ability. Set kind of in the Pokemon world with the overall Pokemon arching goal of getting the master Pokemon cards because the Pokemon card masters are retiring through getting 8 gym badges. I mean, somebody was stretching real hard when they made this game. So, I mean, God bless them. But yeah, if you love this game, go get you some. If you don't want to play a Pokemon the card game, guess what? You probably know you don't need to buy this game.
Now, actually, I do want to know, I think I know the answer already, considering how the main Pokemon series went, but when you're playing in the card battles, is there any kind of animation? Like, do they make any effort to bring the characters that are on the cards out of the cards and sort of make them seem real, or are you literally looking at virtual cards?
You are looking at 8-bit versions of virtual cards.
Okay, so the artwork on them probably doesn't look that great.
When you zoom into a card, you can definitely tell that they faithfully tried to replicate the artwork on the original cards.
But in 8-bit graphics. That's interesting.
Which I respect. I mean, a lot of them look good for, you know, the Game Boy Color.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it is the Game Boy Color. What was this resolution, like 200 dots? I mean, you're not dealing with a lot here.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, it's
pixel art. So.
Yeah. Now, was there another one? I can't remember.
Well, there was a game for GBA called Card Hero that never came out in America. It was well received in Japan.
And that must
be what
I'm thinking of.
There's an import review on our website, and it was considered the sort of follow up. I think there were slightly different rules, but very similar premise. And there was, for a while, a lot of anticipation that it might come to America, but for whatever reason, like a lot of GBA games, it never did.
Yeah, I mean,
but the GBA was viable for much longer in Japan than it was in the West.
Right. Yeah, because
well
that was
beyond the DS.
I mean, when we started on this show, we were talking about Nintendo trying to kill the GBA in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. This crew, not this show.
In 2006. No, 2008.
That is crazy.
Yeah. Early 2008. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, GBA was really popular, and Nintendo definitely wanted people to move on and make DS games instead. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's move on. My new business, I'll start off with a game that is hardly relevant. It's Call of Duty Black Ops 2 for Wii U, released 2 years ago, over 2 years ago. And there are two other Call of Duties since then, one of which is also available on the Wii U. I guess the newest one is not. And I am interested in the newest one. I just right now I'm on a moratorium of buying games until I get a job. But I wanted to finish Black Ops 2 because I never did. I started the campaign probably more than once. And, you know, as you guys know, I'm on my third Wii U system for various reasons. And anyway, so I finally got around to it. I figured, well, I've got some time. I should finish this game that I've had staring at me forever. And, you know, of course, the campaigns aren't that long. This one was probably a little longer than I wanted it to be or expected. But it could also be that I just already played through the first two or three missions more than once before this. So I just really wanted them to be over with and get to the new stuff. And, you know, I can say that I still like the idea of Black Ops 2 quite a bit, in that the majority of the game takes place in the future, in the year 2024, 25. And there's a lot of cute things in there, like there's an aircraft carrier called the Obama, you know, because I always name them after presidents. And there's a female president, of course. That's how you know it's the future. And and also, this is a sign of the times that this game is 2 years old. But David Petraeus is the Secretary of Defense. I have a feeling that one's probably never going to happen now. But you know, the people making this game didn't know how that was all going to work out for him. So anyway, there's some kind of funny, quaint stuff about the futuristic setting from as it was envisioned 2 years ago. But I like the stuff in the future. I think it's generally more exciting. It's fun to see the futuristic technology. The weapons tend to be a little flashier and more fun to use. You've got scanners that will detect people through walls. At late in the game, you get a really cool sniper rifle that's it's kind of like the Farsight in Perfect Dark. You know, it's got an X-ray scope on it, and you can charge up the shots to shoot through walls. So you can see guys through structures and then shoot them. And they may never know that you're there. So that's exciting. It's probably a little overpowered, but I'm not complaining. So there's a lot of fun stuff like that. And there's some good vehicle moments where you get to, especially at the end, you get to fly a fighter jet. That's it's like a VTOL hover mode. And so it controls kind of like a helicopter, but smoother. And then it can switch into fighter jet mode where it goes really fast and you can barely control it. But there's a fair bit of the shooting in this game that I really don't like, and there's a lot of stuff in the campaign that I found mostly just annoying. I think number one is one thing I learned is that pretty much anytime you get to an open area, you have to look up because they tend to put guys with rocket launchers up high, and you have to kill them first because otherwise you will never get anywhere. Because when they shoot a rocket launcher, if it's even anywhere close to you, and they don't have to have very good aim at all. But if they shoot anywhere close to you, you'll get like fuzzy vision and ringing in your ears, and then you have no idea what's going on, and you're guaranteed to be killed in the next 10 seconds every single time. So that's pretty annoying, I think.
What? Really?
Yeah. Well, it's a big problem with Call of Duty, and this game is just one example out of the series, but a lot of times the game's idea of making things more intense and more exciting is to obscure your vision in some way,
right,
and make it harder for you to understand what the hell is going on.
I say this without any intention of demeaning anybody. The Michael Bay eye is the action. You know, big explosions, swirling action, just confusion, loud noises.
Yes, but also as soon as anything big happens in combat, and I don't mean cutscenes, I just mean playing the game – if anything big happens around you, you're pretty much guaranteed that your screen is going to be covered in red blotches and you're going to have no idea what you're looking at, which is probably going to get you killed, right? So the game can be really frustrating at times, even on – I'm sure I was playing on normal difficulty or maybe even lower than that. But it's very hard to be aware of the environment and to understand what's going on in the levels because – every time you turn around a corner, everything just goes fuzzy, you know, because somebody threw a grenade or somebody shot you or somebody hit you or something. And it's like, it's so difficult to even maintain situational awareness. Your peripheral vision blows in this game. I don't know if that's a setting. I don't know if that's something in the engine that they could improve on, but it feels like you're always looking through this very narrow cone of vision. And there's so much stuff happening all around you, and you don't understand really what's going on anyway, because they never tell you ahead of time where you're going. They never explain the layout of the level or where, you know, what you're supposed to be doing next. It's always just, well, just follow this dot, you know, do this thing, and then we'll tell you to do this other thing.
Typically, yeah, or follow this guy or whatever they trump up.
But you never really understand why you're doing the things you're doing, and then they'll throw you up into this big open area where you don't know where anything is situated, you're not at all prepared for it, and they just have guys shooting you from like every side, and it's pretty frustrating because it's like, I don't know where the cover spots are, I don't know where these guys are hiding. Sometimes they yell things out at you, but a lot of times they don't. And the ultimate example of that to me is grenades. I think the way this series handles grenades is unforgivable. It's just absolutely frustrating in every way because there's a grenade indicator thing that comes up, right? And this is a band-aid to cover up the fact that you as a first-person shooter player have no peripheral vision whatsoever. So yeah. If someone throws a grenade near you, number one, you're not going to hear it because the battles are so loud and chaotic. Number two, you'll probably never see it, right? So they have this magical spidey sense that tells you that a grenade is nearby, except it doesn't tell you until about a tenth of a second before you die.
Yeah, I'm just curious as to how you think they could even solve that, though, with a first-person shooter. I mean, the whole idea is to show you what you're looking at.
John,
what's to the left and right of you, right?
One option, wraparound TVs.
I don't know. Oculus Rift.
I think Oculus will be better for this kind of game. I really do. Especially for that sort of thing.
But
I
even then, you still only get tunnel vision. Literally.
You know, you're still looking where you're looking, right?
Yeah, of course. But also, it's... I think the game has a tendency to try to distract you a lot with a whole bunch of things. And part of one of the biggest problem with the grenade indicator, and this could have improved in the last couple games since then, but it's very small. It doesn't appear in a part of the screen where you're likely to see it while you're playing the game. It's very faint, and it's like translucent and like just sort of grayscale colored. Mm-hmm. So it blends in with everything else.
Yep.
And they don't show it to you until right before the grenade goes off. And so most of the time when I saw it, there was absolutely no way for me to react to it or do anything about it before I died.
Yep.
So it's like, well, thanks for showing me there's a grenade there, but you might as well have not bothered because it was going to kill me anyway.
Yeah.
So show it earlier, make the grenades have a longer timing maybe or something. I don't know. But it killed me over and over and over. And I just didn't – every time it happened, I was like, I didn't learn anything from that. And because the enemies throw grenades randomly. So you could just play through the same sequence over again and do all the same things. And that time you may get through it because they just never throw a grenade at you.
Yeah, it's like that's the problem that I usually see in most first-person shooters is the fact that, okay, so either, like you said, they don't indicate properly where the grenade is, like either it's too small or you know too much is happening and it just blends in, or they don't really tell you how far away you are from the grenade, so you have to just pretty much sprint in a direction away from the grenade, so you really have no idea, like you can't gauge how much damage you're actually going to take. Are you going to die? Are you just going to, you know, get maimed?
If that indicator shows up, does that mean I'm in the kill range, or does that mean I shouldn't go any closer to it? Maybe I'm okay staying where I am because maybe I'm in cover and I don't want to move out because something else will kill me if I do.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a certain awareness and transparency about the situation that the game does not provide, and it's very frustrating when you're playing through the campaign.
Yep.
And it's been a long time since I played the online multiplayer of this. I remember it working well. I didn't even bother this time because I'm sure no one's playing it 2 years later. No one was really playing it in the first place. But maybe the grenade stuff works better there. I don't know. But in the campaign, it's obnoxious. But there are fun parts of the campaign, and geez, I have to say the story. I actually heard Alex Claffey praise the campaign story on Connectivity last week, and I don't get it. I don't know what he's talking about. I think the story is complete garbage nonsense.
Alex, he will fight you.
It's just very run of the mill. Like which one is this? Is this the one where you go to Alaska and you go underwater and there's like the oil rig out in Alaska or something like that where you have to bomb
it? No, I don't think so. No, you spend some time in the early part. There's a lot of flashbacks where you're going back to the 80s and you're in Vietnam and you're in Afghanistan and Nicaragua, Panama.
Yep.
But then in the future you're in, I think, China. You go to a crazy floating city resort in Singapore.
Yep.
And,
you go to LA.
And then, of course,
too,
there's the Battle of Los Angeles, which is obligatory in every Call of Duty. They have to destroy America at some point.
Yep.
But the game story seems designed to confuse you mostly. It's kind of like James Bond, where you're like hop skipping all over the world and following this crazy madman. Except it's even, and James Bond movies tend to be kind of confusing because they're very fast paced and sort of discontinuous. But in Call of Duty, it's even a lot worse because you aren't even playing as the same character in every mission. And in this game, at some points, you're even playing as the bad guy for no reason. It doesn't make any sense that you would be playing as the bad guy in this game.
Well, it's gritty. It's raw.
But that guy is completely unsympathetic. And
Guillaume has to get his shots in.
Yeah. It's just stupid. I mean, I'll put my shots in. I think the stories in these games are really bad. I think they're all flash, but there's no substance. And if you actually sit down and try to track what's happening, it'll completely fall apart. And I don't even think it holds together on the surface. But maybe they throw so much information, so many names and military jargon and acronyms at you and different countries and places that maybe they think it makes them sound smart, but I don't think these stories are smart at all.
And, yeah, it always cracks me up when they're like, we got a writer from this Hollywood film, and it's like the most ridiculous story ever. Like, it's like something out of, like, you know, it's just terrible. Yeah. I just laugh.
I can only imagine, like, a Hollywood script writer would, like, look at these games and just kind of throw up their hands and say, well, I'll try to throw in something to spice it up a little bit.
Johnny, but Johnny, have you played seen Red Dawn? The new one?
The original?
No, the new one.
Oh, God, no.
I'm sure they're both bad.
Hollywood's the new one is amazing.
Well, I think the co-writer on Black Ops 2 was David S. Goyer, who's a pretty well-known Hollywood scriptwriter and has written some good stuff, but this is not one of them.
Yeah, so, yeah. I'm just saying I wouldn't put action movies on too high a pedestal here.
Well, no, I'm not.
Because that movie is fucking stupid as shit.
Sure. Yeah, well, the original Red Dawn's pretty stupid too, but it's an nostalgic
Avenge
favorite.
Me! Sorry, it's a line from it. It's awesome.
Anyway, there's some fun to be had in Call of Duty, including Black Ops 2, and I think it's still probably one of my favorite campaigns just because of the settings and the kind of gear that you get to use. I mean, there's like a wingsuit sequence, and you know, you get to do some really crazy stuff. You fight guys who have invisibility camo, like the Predator, and that stuff is, you know, more fun to me than just doing another World War II thing. And that's why I'm interested.
I mean, they haven't done
warfare,
that in a while, though.
Hmm?
They haven't done a World War II thing in a while, though.
No, and I World wonder of if War, they're back in 2009. Go back to that. I wonder if at some point that becomes kind of retro and stylish to go back and say we're going to do World War II.
I mean, I think
they've done
a totally new way.
I think the one way you could do it in a new way is that with the additional processing power now, you could do something like the Battle of Kursk, where it's like thousands upon thousands of just shit shooting shells at each other. You have the capacity to render that now versus before where you could only render this run through alleyways and shoot at small units of guys. I mean, that is the last war where you have major set pieces moving against one another. So you could try to do something with that.
I fully expect them to do the whole time travel route, I think, at some point.
Just Call of Time Blops?
Well, they'll go back to Advanced Warfare in Ancient Rome. You'll be like, you know, fighting at the Parthenon and shit. I fully expect. I mean, where else can they go?
Yes. The ancient Roman Parthenon, John.
Whatever. Greek, Rome. I'm keeping 100 like the Romans, buddy.
All right. Well, it'll be interesting to see because they did finally, you know, fully breach the futuristic model. And, of course, there will be one next year, and we don't know what it is yet. But I'm a little bit curious to see how they handle that for sure.
John's the world's only fan of Rise, Son of Rome, by the way.
Exactly.
That game has its... weird.
No, it doesn't.
It has release date.
It does. But the other thing I've been playing is not relevant at all to Nintendo, but I have spent a ton of time with it, which is Dragon Age Origins, or Dragonage, as I like to call it. So, with the new Inquisition game getting amazing reviews, I'm really excited to try that on my PS4. But again, I'm trying not to buy games right now. So I had the first one on PS3, I got it for like $3 a few months ago on some kind of crazy PSN sale. And I thought, well, I've always wanted to play that. Maybe I'll get around to it one day. Well, guess what? Now's the perfect time. I don't have anything else to do. So I've put a bunch of time into Dragon Age, the first one, and I really like it. And it's not a game that I really could tell you very much specific about it. It seems very similar to some other games that I've played. It is lot like Skyrim,
okay,
for sure. It's in third person though, and the main difference between this and Skyrim is the world is not open to explore. You just kind of pick places from a map, which is, you know, kind of disappointing, although some of the locations you go to are big and you can still explore those and get some satisfaction from that. But the writing is way better. Like this game definitely has that BioWare polish to it that people talk about. And, like Mass Effect, a lot of the game and a lot of my favorite things in the game are just talking to people and going through these dialogue trees where I get like, even more than in Mass Effect, sometimes I get 5, 6, 7, 8 different choices of things to say to people, and they're all wildly different and they respond very differently depending on what you say. And some of them have pretty big consequences. You know, they may end up in you killing them. They may end up in you not fighting them at all. Or maybe they hate you. Maybe they join your party. Maybe they go kill some other character. It feels like a lot of these conversations are really important, and you really have a lot of choices to choose your own adventure and kind of make the story go in the direction that suits you. And they don't mess around with any kind of like morality system or anything like that. The only thing in that vein is that the other characters in your party will react differently to how you handle situations. So they'll approve or disapprove. Sometimes they'll make a comment during the cutscene where they'll say, whatever, I don't think that's a good idea. And your rating with them will go down. But there is no universal, you know, really forced, silly kind of morality system. So I like that quite a bit, and I think it works better than in Mass Effect. So yeah, I've enjoyed it a lot now. I'm probably about halfway through the game, and I don't know if I'm going to finish it, but I'm still enjoying playing it, and hopefully before too much longer I get to jump ahead to the new one, because it definitely seems like a world and a style of game that I want to spend more time with.
I mean, is the world and the characters, is it interesting, or is it kind of hokey or generic? Or
I think it's pretty interesting. It is elves and dwarves and demons, and that's the reason I didn't play this when it first came out, because I was so sick of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah,
in 2009.
It looks really generic, and that's one of the reasons why I've never touched it. It's because Dragon Age. It's like, okay.
Yeah, if you just describe it in broad terms, there's nothing really special about it. But it's in the details where it really does well. I think it's a very well-realized fantasy world.
To John's point, it's not just that it uses – I mean, it straight steals Tolkien iconography. I mean, it's mm-hmm. that they very clearly watched the movies a lot of times when they designed their world. Like,
I don't know about the world, but some of the enemies for sure.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I mean. Like characters and like how, like what a dwarf looks like. It's like, all right, look, you fuckers.
No, the interesting part about it is the characters that accompany you are really very fleshed out, interesting characters. And the way the world connects, because you play this guy who's like a, you know, like an ancient class of ranger who's supposed to protect the world from the oncoming evil, this wave of evil. And you're going around trying to convince everybody that they need to respect these like centuries old treaties that they signed that would say if this ever happened, they would come help you. And the way that all these different races and factions connect to each other, it's very political. And you know, if I mean, it's for the same reason Game of Thrones doesn't sound that interesting until you watch it and you realize, oh wow, this is actually way more intelligent and detailed than anything in Lord of the Rings, which is these, you know, very broad strokes of you know, good and evil and things like that. So I think it's only in the details that it really works and becomes special and interesting. But with a game like this, you spend so much time with it that you really get engrossed in those details. So it works out pretty well. But yeah, like on the surface, it would be hard for me to tell you anything about this game or the world that wouldn't sound generic fantasy, you know, and that's too bad. But ultimately, I think I've been very happy that I've finally dug into it. And it's almost immediately, actually, from the very beginning, I think it started to do things that pulled me in and made me interested in the world and all the different pieces that are moving around in it. So they do a good job of pulling you into it really, really quickly. All right, well, let's move on to more generic fantasy crap from John Lindemann.
Yep, and also Nintendo stuff. I have to admit, I've been playing World of Warcraft.
Again, we're just biding our time until Smash Brothers tonight.
Yes, I do have Smash Brothers on pre-order, so it's on deck. I got it from Amazon, though, so I won't be playing at midnight. So, because, you know, fridge cleaning and all that.
Yeah, I do, John.
Yeah, everybody does. Everybody listening to this podcast does. That's for damn sure.
You know who doesn't know about it?
Who?
This guy. You know why?
Because you're a baller.
Because he buys his games when they're on sale in retail copies, bitches.
I'm a retail man myself. I mean, I don't really do this digital stuff. Ones and zeros. Come on, I can't play ones and zeros.
You know what?
All video games are digital.
I've got fucking twos, son. You know what two is? It's two ones.
I have legitimate little people living inside every device I have, so.
There you go. They just move all bits around.
It's amazing. So
they're very fast on the modern computers.
They are. They are. They run faster than ever. So, yeah. World of Warcraft released an expansion this week. Well, last week? Yeah. I don't know.
It was last week, I think.
It's all a blur. But, yeah. Warlords of Draenor is the new one.
So pause real quick. Do they just have a script that generates these names at this point?
No, they don't. No, they went off script the last... Well, I know, it's always something of something, usually. Yeah. Actually, no, that's actually not true, because number two was Burning Crusade, then there was Wrath of the Lich King, then there was Cataclysm, and then there was Mists of Pandaria, and now it's Warlords of Draenor. But yes, it is a fairly rote title. So this one, it's actually... done pretty well. They sold 3.3 million copies in 24 hours. So, which
that's insane.
Kind of leads.
We're at what? This was the 10-year anniversary, right?
Yeah, this is the 10-year anniversary. So they just announced that it's back up to 10 million subscribers, which was kind of like, yeah, everybody, you know, World of Warcraft jumped the shark, et cetera, et cetera. It was down to like 6.8 million. It's dying,
fucking,
and you know, the you know,
pays, man.
Everybody was proclaiming doom, but yeah. So, and the reason why I think that is because this particular one kind of goes back to the roots of the original games, which, of course, everybody fell in love with to begin with. Like, Warcraft, Warcraft II, Tides of Darkness, and Warcraft III, The Frozen Throne, and the characters therein. So, you know, you always have kind of like it's always like the orcs versus the humans, but then above that, you have kind of everybody, the whole planet, versus this demon horde, which kind of came to the forefront in the Burning Crusade, which was the second expansion. And so they're kind of going back to that, because in the Burning Crusade, you were it was centered around this area called Outland, which was a shattered version of the original planet Draenor. And of course, there was like a big demon war, whatever. I'm not too familiar with the total details of that since I wasn't playing at that time.
I expect you to know all the lore.
I will, buddy, one day. But anyway, so this is the reason why I think this is so popular is because this is actually going back to that planet as it used to be. So it kind of fulfills that sort of fan service curiosity of what did this planet look like before it was destroyed. So and it's really well done, but there's also a lot of other smart things they did with it. The zones really look gorgeous. You know, they still have that cartoony sort of feel to them, but they've updated the character models completely, which is a huge deal because you were literally playing character models that were designed in like probably 2002. So it's like, you know, fingers? What are fingers? No one really has fingers because everybody's hands.
All hair
just,
is, everybody has short hair.
Yeah.
It's all solid.
Yeah, it was like, you know,
skull helmet.
Yeah, it's like hands were just like big paddles. You know, the character models look really ridiculous.
Everybody
right?
swims great.
Yeah, it's just,
do they
you
look
know.
Good or just less bad now?
No, they look really good now. Like, they look really, really good. And so, but they also did a lot of cool stuff. Like, you have your own garrison now. Like, they drop you in the new area. And you have your own sort of fort that you can outfit as you want. So if you want to, you know, like if you have certain professions, you can have kind of a profession vendor, and you know, you have for your garrison, you have resources that you can kind of trade in, and you can add on to your fort certain things that generate these resources for you. And then one really smart thing they did is, of course, you can go around and you can do quests in all of these different zones. But what usually happens is, you know, you run through about half of the zones, and by that time you've, you know, fully, you know, you've maxed out your character, so you no longer need the experience points. So you don't really bother with the quests anymore because they're just kind of like story flavor text at that point. And you go off and you start doing raids and try to get gear in other ways and stuff like that. So, I mean, like, I know in Mists I didn't make it through all the way through all the different zones because I pretty much did – like the first three zones you go through really hardcore, and then I reached the cap and maxed out my experience. And after that, I didn't really need to do the story anymore, so I just never really came back to it, right? So with this one, with your garrison, you can get followers that can also get you resources. So you have your little roster of guys that you can send out and assign them to missions. And, you know, the missions repopulate every few hours. And, you know, I would say it's almost like, it reminds me almost like of... you know, and this is going to sound bad. It's like, it almost reminds me of like a smartphone game.
Oh, no.
But the thing is with
that
is that it's context for me. I don't give a shit if those
smartphone games have built a lot of their mechanics off of MMOs.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things where it's the kind of game where, like, in a free to play smartphone game, they would try to suck money out of you by having you come back.
They would be selling you a something to speed up this process.
Exactly. Like that. But with this, they just, I mean, you're a subscriber already, so they just kind of let you do it. So it's optional rather than mandatory. It's just, you know, like, you want to get your characters up because, you know, you can get them up to 100 and cap them out experience wise. And then you can get them, you can kind of upgrade them from just a common character to like an uncommon and then to an epic. So they, you know, they get stronger, they get more attacks, and you can have them run different missions and stuff like that. So it's a really cool diversion that is good to have there because it breaks up the pace of the rest of the game. Because, you know, there's a lot of things that in this game, like anything else, I mean, when you're doing something for a long time, it gets kind of grindy, right? So this is something like that you can do passively and just have going in the background while you're doing other stuff. And it updates you and says, hey, your guys completed this mission. So you come back and, you know, see what they did and whether or not they failed at it or succeeded at it and what their reward was and stuff like that. So it's really, really smart. And it's been really well received. I think everybody's liking it pretty universally in the WoW community. So, yeah, it's going to be a large part of my gaming diet going forward. I think it's much better. I think people generally felt that the storylines was kind of going away from the original World of Warcraft. So I think this feels a lot more Warcrafty than past expansions, at least the past two, because, you know, Cataclysm was very much lore that happened before the game that if you're a lore nerd, that's cool, but otherwise you'll be like, what? I don't care. This doesn't have anything to do with, like,
John,
Warcraft
I've
1,
read
2, or
3. All the World of Warcraft novels.
Yeah.
All of them.
And, you know, Mist of Pandaria was, like, didn't have anything to do with the original games, really. I mean, in fact, the panda characters...
total side story, right?
Yeah, really, is a total side story with all new characters. And, in fact, the Pandaren race in itself actually started off as an April Fool's joke that Blizzard played on its players. So...
which... that's awesome that they actually put that in the game eventually.
Yeah, they actually did put it in the game because you know, you can see how people there
much respect.
Like the really old school fans would be like, "Fuck, that's bullshit. Pandas, who wants pandas? I'm quitting." You know,
it's Kung Fu Panda, man.
Yeah.
It's Kung Fu Panda.
So,
They are pandas who do martial arts. So yeah, there was that for a while.
They're not pandas, they're Pandaren. They're like panda like aliens or
yeah,
yeah, yeah. So, yeah, and this one, but this one is like straight in the wheelhouse of like orcs, humans, demons, Draenei, which is the race of people from Draenor, and it's just like, you know, it hits all, it's fan service. It's like, so I'm not surprised it's really popular because people are like, ooh, Draenei, I love Draenei. I used to play a paladin way back in the day, you know, whatever. So but yeah, it's good.
Draenei,
it's really, really good.
So WoW has become its own nostalgia.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been around for 10 years,
man.
It's
just so weird. I mean, it is still in a very reductive sense, it is still the same game, and it is now paying tribute to itself. This isn't even like a sequel or a remake or, you know, a spiritual successor. This is still the game, but it's now sort of paying tribute to itself.
Yeah, it's like this is actually an alternate timeline that is set because there's
fuck everything.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, it's an alternate timeline story that.
Fucking bullshit.
Yeah, so it goes back like 35 years, and there was one like major kind of thing that happened where like the orcs drank this demon blood and they became the demon horde kind of thing, right? And so what this does is it goes back and kind of answers the question sort of like, what if that didn't happen? What, you know, so it's interesting. It's really interesting from like a lore standpoint. It's pretty clever what they did, but yeah, I mean, it's become so large now, like they can really do whatever they want. And the important thing is they own the IP. They can do whatever the fuck they want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I made the joke about novels, there are like 21.
Oh, there's a ton of them,
novels. Yeah.
Well, and the ridiculous. Game itself is like a giant novel too. I mean, the amount of text and lore that is just embedded in it that most people just skip.
Yeah, most people just skip it.
Could probably fill many volumes.
Well, what's the point of even reading them when once Disney buys Blizzard, then they're just going to get rid of the extended universe and it's all this time invested for nothing, you know? I'm not better about Star Wars.
Yeah, no one is. No one is at all.
Well, there will be a WoW movie next Christmas, I think.
Yep.
Pretty soon.
Yeah, it's coming out and that's going to be...
from a good director.
Yeah.
It is pretty soon from now, not pretty soon to when you would think a WoW movie would have happened.
Right. Well, sure. It's been a development hell for like 7 years, but I guess they just showed the first
footage. It's like this movie made a lot more sense 9 years ago.
It really did. I mean, the thing is, like WoW's peak was like 2008, and it's been slowly declining ever since then. And I don't know. You know how these things
well,
are.
With 10 million people still subscribed, I'm sure they feel pretty good about putting that out there. And,
yeah.
And, you know, fantasy stuff is pretty popular just in the mass culture. So if they make it something that's accessible to people like me who've never touched WoW, then maybe mm-hmm. the movie will do okay. Like I said, it is from a very legitimate, really good movie director.
Yep.
And it's all CG, so I don't know if that's a good idea. But I'm curious. Like, it's...
Well, it's not all CG. There are actual actors in it, like.
Oh, I thought it was entirely CG.
Nope. Huh. Nope. It's a mix. I mean, they're actually done filming it, and it's like, it's coming out, I think, in the middle of, it's coming out in like early 2016, and like from here until then, it's just all CG work, post-production stuff, so.
So you're saying this movie will come out when the game it is based on is 12 years old?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be like on the level of like Lord of the Rings type stuff, like in terms of CG quality, I'm sure. So it'll be pretty cool.
It would be nice for there to be a truly great video game movie after all this time. I don't know if this will be the one, but I'm sure that's what they're going for.
Hey,
and
Double Dragon. It's amazing. Yeah, it is great. God. It is great. Double Dragon is great.
Yeah.
All right, so let's wrap up new business with some actual Nintendo games from Guillaume.
Sure. Well, very quickly, I'm still playing a lot of Mario Kart 8. Yes, we did figure out how to unlock the ramp in the Hyrule Castle track. You just hit the three switches, as you do, in Zelda games, so that's pretty awesome. And I'm just enjoying the tracks, like even the old ones, more than before. Like, it's just fun to play this game. I love it. And there was this awesome moment last night when I was just playing. I told people on Twitter, okay, I'm going to be online in Mario Kart 8, whatever. Like, you join me or not. And some people joined me.
Or join me or die.
So I saw some familiar faces. And then all of a sudden, you know, in the waiting room where you see all the people's me's, there's a second Guillaume that joins the fray. Like, my own me. Named Guillaume, and it was just a listener probably who was trolling me, and that was hilarious.
I totally approve
that. Doppelganger.
Yeah, so that was pretty great. But I've also been playing some Wii U eShop games. So on Monday, I started playing Tengami, and I also stopped. I finished
I
Tengami.
I stopped playing Tengami.
I was playing it, and then I stopped immediately.
No, I started it and then I finished it because it's a very, very short game, about, I don't know, a couple of hours at most. It's a game I was interested in that I didn't really... I should have read up more on it. I probably would have held back from buying it, but the stuff that I had been hearing sounded good to me. You know, oh, okay, it's made by ex-Rare employees. I didn't even bother to look up, like,
which... So is Bonsai Barber, which
yeah,
boy?
Like, kind of. But, well, probably, actually. Nyam Nyam Games, I think they're called. Anyway, and I heard that the music was from David Wise, which is, you know, like a good sign.
From Rare, yeah.
Yeah. And
I think he did a lot of the Donkey Kong Country soundtracks.
Yes. Yeah, I think he did the first two. If that's correct, or maybe like the first and the third. I don't know. He did a bunch of them, and I think he did Tropical Freeze as well.
Which
I hope
really
I'm
good.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, like the stuff I had heard was good, and like it does have this kind of paper craft style to it. Actually, the whole game is kind of this pop-up book. And it has this Japanese art style. You know, there's a lot of, cherry tree blooming, you know, like there's a, you're playing, I don't know if he's a samurai, I don't think he's carrying a sword, but he's, you know, wearing kimono, and he's got, I don't know, it seems to be set in medieval Japan, or, you know, a kind of fantasy medieval Japan. And so I downloaded it, started it. It's mostly an iPad game. And I
mean, it is an iPad game.
It is an iPad game, actually. So if I had known that, maybe I would have held off. But I'm not, like, just because it's an iPad game doesn't mean it's bad. But the
it does sort of limit it in some ways.
Yeah, well, the game limits itself in many ways. Like, it's this story. Like, you control this character. You point where you want it to go, and he goes there very, very slowly. And it's kind of, you know, it's annoying that he walks so slowly, but it's kind of a blessing. Otherwise, you'd be done with a game in like 40 minutes. But yeah, so you walk around and you've got these simple puzzles to solve, and they do stick with the pop-up book motif. And so, like, you'll have tabs that you have to pull. And, like, one of the puzzles, quote-unquote, has you pull these four tabs attached to these bells, and you have to ring them in the right order to have, like, four wolves owl at them and then fall asleep. And if you do them in the wrong order, then, the wolf is going to growl, and then you're going to have to start over. So... yeah, that's one of the early puzzles, but because the game is so short, it's also one of the late puzzles, you know? Like, there's not much to this game. I guess my favorite thing that it does, and, you know, I do want to give it credit for that, is that you do use the touchscreen to swipe the pages of the book, you know? Like, you move the character to a door, you know, outside of a building, and then you get the option to use the touchscreen and drag your finger from the right edge to the left edge to flip open the book and to flip the page. And it's not a digital motion, it's actually analog. So if you keep your finger in the middle of the screen, you know, like you're in the middle of flipping the page, and then you can flip it back. And they actually use that in the puzzles, because at some point you're going to have to basically count certain symbols hidden in this setting. And the camera is positioned so that you don't see all the symbols, and you'll have to look, like, very carefully as you flip the pages where, like, hidden symbols, where some symbols are hidden. So I thought that was a pretty cool touch. But... yeah, that's basically the most involved puzzle in this game.
But everything else sucks.
Yeah. I mean, it's a gorgeous game, but I would recommend playing it on an iPad, because most of the time, because you have to touch the screen to move the character there, you have to be looking at the screen, right? Like, you can't drag the cursor around. You have to look at where you're pointing.
Yeah.
And so most of the time you're looking at the gamepad screen, and it's just not that sharp. So the game does not look that good. Like, you've got a beautiful art style, but you're not looking at the optimal screen for it. So you want to be looking up at your TV screen a lot, but you have to go back and forth like that. It's a little bit annoying.
I'm worried about this with the new Kirby and the Rainbow Curse.
Yeah, well,
we've seen that.
A really pretty game, and I want to look at it on my big TV, but you have to use the touchscreen on the gamepad.
And yep.
It's weird. This is not something we had to deal with on Wii games, because you were using the pointer and they would put a cursor up on the screen, and that maybe didn't look so great, but, you know, waving a finger all over the graphics, but at least you were looking at it on your big screen.
Right.
And I think with some of these gamepad driven touchscreen games, it'd be nice if they at least offered an option to play it with the pointer. On your TV if you prefer that, because you can do pretty much the same stuff. It's still a single point of two-dimensional input.
Well, you could solve that very easily with the case of the Kirby, whatever they're calling it right now. But just by wherever you have the pen, it's got the icon of you drawing. I mean, relative position, you should be able to keep it pretty on nose.
Right, and you would hold down a button to actually draw the line, or what?
Or just start drawing.
That was well.
So if you put it down, it doesn't draw anything. It just shows where you are on the big screen, and then as you start drawing it.
James, did you play the DS game?
I did, but it was so damn long ago.
It requires a great deal of precision to do a lot of the things in that game, and I think you know, sort of willy-nilly drawing on the screen just to figure out where your cursor is not a good option. Now, having a cursor so that you can keep the stylus down on the touchscreen, but then using a button to activate whether it's actually drawing or not, that is a pretty smart solution that you mentioned, and that could be really good. I just don't know. I mean, none of us have. Well, I played the Rainbow Curse at, and it felt exactly like the DS game. They didn't have anything like that at the time.
Also, they could always like add pointer control. I mean, you did have to lay down tracks in Kirby Epic Yarn, and it was kind of the same gameplay, although it was much slower. But I think they could make it work with a pointer.
Yeah, I think that would work. It would be a little trickier to do in that game because it's so fast-paced. You're sometimes drawing pretty complex shapes. But it seems like it would be, again, a good option. I guess we'll see how they do it.
But yeah, Tengami, just to end with this, it's very, very much inspired. You can tell that these guys played Sword and Sorcery. That iPad game that kind of blew up on social media because you could tweet the dialogue from the game, and that was so annoying.
There's a lot of things annoying about that game.
Yeah, I don't like it. I really tried, but I really don't like it. But it's, you can tell that it's basically the same kind of thing going on, and it right down to the fact that you can tweet, quote-unquote, some stuff, like it tells you, oh, you want to tweet this? The problem is there's not a whole lot of dialogue in the game. You basically get a haiku at the end of a chapter, and there's three chapters. So there are three haikus in a game that you can post to Miiverse. And so if you go to that Miiverse's, to that Miiverse community, you'll just see that haiku posted over and over again.
Good planning. So, good planning by everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
Guess what I am doing right now. Guess the exact thing I am doing this second right now.
I don't know. Downloading the game?
No, go to the Miiverse community to laugh at it.
Yeah, for sure.
It's pretty bad.
Certainly some people like this game quite a bit. I know Don Koopman gave it a pretty good review, although he noted some of the same complaints you have. About it being short and the guy walking really slow.
Right. I just it's so uninvolved. I would just watch a playthrough on YouTube. And if you really want the David Weiss,
I know.
Yeah, like that.
It's unintentionally harsh, anyway. But truthful.
If you want the David Weiss soundtrack, I think you can buy it, or maybe it's even free on the game's website. So. There you go. The other eShop game that I've been playing is Squid's Odyssey. This is on Wii U and 3DS, and this is one of those games where in Europe, if you buy one version, you get both. It does have cross-buy, so good on the developer. Yeah, there are more releases.
Is it a different publisher? Is it a different publisher in Europe?
No, it's the same, but they basically North America won't allow it. So address your complaints to Reggie.
I guess so.
So yeah, I'm sure the game plays just as well and is probably even more suited for portable play than playing on the Wii U, but I'm really enjoying it on the Wii U. On Twitter, I've made a mistake. I was wrong. I described the game as a mix of like an RPG with Angry Birds mechanics. That is incorrect. It's actually Fire Emblem with pool mechanics.
So billiards.
Like billiards?
Billiards, yeah.
Like swimming pool. Oh, God.
Like billiards.
Explain that.
Yeah, so you've got your team of characters, and they've got their own stats, and there's basically three classes. You've got a shooter, some sort of brawler, and a healer, and
a scooter?
A scout. Thank you.
A schooner. It's actually a
scout.
Ship.
So they've each got their own. they've each got their own, special ability. But the main mode of how they move around and how they attack is you use the stick or you use the touchscreen to touch them and pull back and then release, and so you send them straight onto enemies. And most of the time, you want to be sending the enemies into the void. Like, they're always on platforms, and you can push these crabs off the platforms, and that kills them instantly. So that's definitely something you want to try to do. Although usually that means getting close to the edge yourself, which means exposing yourself to insta-kills like that. So, you know, you got to be careful. But you can also, you know, every enemy and your guys have also health. And so you can just whittle down their health through repeated attacks. And yeah, so as I said, like, it's kind of billiards. So the game does have a currency, pearls, which you can buy, which you can level up, with which you can level up your characters and buy them gear. And you get more pearls when you do things like ricochet. How do you call that? Side shots or like?
Yeah.
Like bank shots or?
Right. Anyway, so I should have brushed up on my billiards terminology before explaining this game. But yeah, so you can do stuff like that. So it's really, you know, like as I said, like the combat is very much inspired by billiards. So that's very original. And the game is a lot of fun. Yeah, I'm loving it. Although it's a little bit simplistic, but because you have lots of risks, like of you know, killing yourself, like you have to be very careful. The interface is very clever in that it tells you pretty much like how far it doesn't tell you how far your character is going to go, but you do have feedback as to how far you're pulling, you know, like it does show you kind of a dial you know, tells you, okay, well, you're pulling this much back, and so you can kind of gauge how far your character is going to go. And if you don't pull back all the way, like if you don't use one huge, you know, full force shot, you can go like several smaller shots, you know, to move around or to attack and to push your enemies onto like urchins.
Yeah.
Urchins. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, damage them even more that way and, things like that. So very clever, very fun. The menus are a little bit confusing. Like the way that you improve your character's stats is that you buy them helmets, and then those helmets you use to imbue their stats into your characters. But then you can also wear the helmets, but it's purely cosmetic. So that really kind of, that confused me for a while. I was like, well, what's the point? I'm wearing this helmet, but what's going on? But it's really just like for looks. So your scout is going to have, you know, a Santa hat or whatever. It's for fun. And, the game has a ton of content. I'm not even halfway through the first campaign, which is about 20 missions long. And there are like 8 campaigns. So I am going to be playing this for a long, long time.
Nice. Well, it sounds pretty interesting. As you were describing this Fire Emblem / Billiards hybrid of Squid Odyssey, it reminded me of a game that I could not think of the name, and I've spent the last couple of minutes looking for it. There's a Super Nintendo game called Fire Striker, which I doubt any of you have ever played. It is a fantasy-style action RPG in which the combat is kind of like pinball. It's really weird. Super weird game, but it's definitely not out on Virtual Console. It was made by Axis Art Amuse.
Oh, God.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, that's...
And it had 4-player support.
But if you've got nothing to do, go look up Axis Art Amuse. The last word is absolutely accurate.
Well, I know my friend Gabe, if he ever listens to this episode, he will remember this game because I played it with him probably at our friend Matt's house at some birthday party or something. I played it, and it's got to be one of the most obscure Super Nintendo games, but it just made me think of it. All right. Well, if Squid's Odyssey is anything like that, I'd be interested in trying it.
Yeah, and one last note, just go look at pictures, videos. It's a very pretty game. It's 2D art, and some of the characters seem to be Miyazaki inspired. Like, it's all hand-drawn, and it's beautiful.
All right. Miyazaki, now on Blu-ray. Okay, mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got your listener mail, so stick around.
Or don't. I don't care. Whatever.
Yeah, dude. We'll be right back.
now playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. So, first up this week, we have Persona Q, Shadow of the Labyrinth review by Kim Keller. Kim describes a insane mashup of the cast from Persona 3 and Persona 4 placed in a dungeon-crawling world of Etrian Odyssey and cheapified. That's a lot to absorb, but then again, so is Persona. Like, I had to absorb the fact I lost my place in reading that script.
Yeah, that was pretty smooth.
But I absorbed it, and you guys don't even know it. You don't even know that I'm lost my place. You'll never know. Next up this week, we have a review of Demon's Crest, a mini-review, because this game is old, and we don't do Virtual Console recommendations anymore, because we sucked at them. Zach takes this much-anticipated Virtual Console release for a spin, and gives the take of somebody entirely new to the series. Unsurprisingly, he finds a way to compare it to Mega Man. Amazingly, he does not mention prehistoric creatures. I'm going to go ahead and mention that one thing this game lacks that its predecessors had: good jumping. Had good jumping, John.
Hey, you can't win them all.
But you can jump and kind of hover and then look to float.
Yeah, it's different. I mean, you know, it comes to territory, man. It's Demon's
one other
Crest.
Thing, yeah, it's Demon's Crest. One other thing with floating jumping, but not Demon's Crest, but does have Mega Man. Super Smash Bros. For Wii U, a review by Neil Ronahan. Finally arrived, the best way ever to play Super Smash Bros. As God intended. Final Destination and no items. Neil's review doesn't cover online play yet, but who cares, really? Final Destination, no items. Be confident that you're playing the right way. The way designed to have no joy whatsoever.
Yeah, the online is a little bit laggy, by the way.
You got it?
Yeah.
John, why are we even fucking doing this? We should just be playing that right now. let's just fucking record us play that, and then we'll just plug this into Now Playing and see how far Johnny gets to do it when he puts the files together. Because this Now Playing's like 42 minutes long. What the fuck happened?
Well, the online would be like, wow, it's frozen up, and there's the loading stuff in the bottom right. There's a loading icon. So
good, it's frozen up like this segment. Perfect.
Yep. All right. And okay, so we have a video of Majora's Mask 3DS versus N64. John Raritan and Ada Brown put the two games side by side to show how the 3DS remakes improve things. Hint, a lot, but that moon still looks hideous. The Swapper review by Zach Miller. All I can say is that you really should read this review just to find out what Zach thinks of a game that he describes as a morbid take on the Double Cherry. Bring a safety word.
Oh, wait, home. What? I feel like that's something that if somebody says it, I should ask, but I'm afraid.
Speaking of Pokemon Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire, we have a review of this. But Don Gutman. Don looks at this Game Boy Advance remake with an eye to how it plays versus the original, as well as Pokemon XY, as well as versus Pokemon XY. Should you be buying this to fill your Pokedex? Or should you be saying Poke next? Yes, I just wrote that.
Is this the MTV show where they just look at web videos and go, oh, damn! Did you just, oh, damn Don Koopman's review? Son,
I may have John 2.0'd it, maybe. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, there we go. Done. Perfect. All this and much, much less of this is available on NintendoWorldReport.com.
Welcome back, everybody. It is time for listener mail, and the address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We would love to hear from you, just like we heard from the following people. The first email is going to be read by James.
Mikey writes, my question is, should Nintendo make a sequel to Super Mario Bros. 2 for the NES? A return to Subcon? Would gamers today accept it? It can work, I think. Mario Luigi Dream Team did have a dream storyline. Why not with Mario 2? I would love each of your opinions on the subject, and also, what would you guys do with this game to make it work? Super Mario Sunshine went out of the box and did something different. And also, Super Mario 3D World had some Easter eggs based on Super Mario Bros. 2. It would be fun for them to revisit this ugly duckling of the Mario Bros. Franchise.
I think 3D World kind of already did revisit it to an extent. With all the different characters who all play differently, and getting to do that stuff simultaneously was a nice touch.
Yeah, and you've got Captain Toad coming out soon that, you can pick up turnips and throw them at enemies. So, again, an homage there.
The question is, do you think they'll ever go back and, like, really do a direct follow-up to this weird black sheep of the Mario franchise?
Yeah, I don't know. I doubt it. I mean,
think about what you do in that game. It plays quite differently.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
That's why it would be cool to do. But
yeah, but some of its mechanics have been kind of taken, adapted into subsequent Mario games. You know, like you mm-hmm. used to not be able to carry the carapace, the shells. And now, Mario 3, you could.
But you carry everything in this game. I mean,
sure.
That's your primary methodology of attack, is to jump on something and pick it up.
Sure, yeah, but the idea of picking up enemies and throwing them, like, in some form, it's present in, like, Yoshi's Story, Yoshi's Island, I mean, and, I don't know. Like, I think that maybe they've kind of taken what they wanted from Super Mario 2, and, they probably don't feel the need to make a game exactly like that again.
I do. They've definitely ripped out a ton of characters from it. Mm-hmm. Birdo and the Shy Guys and, Toad as a playable character was unthinkable in the first game. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of Luigi jumping higher and being a little bit more slippery comes from this game. I agree. I think they've kind of pillaged it for tons of ideas and mechanics and characters. And I wonder if they will, cause the world itself of the world of Subcon isn't that different. I mean, it's distinct because of all those characters in there, and they've already used so many of those that I don't know if there's anything about that world that really comes across as being so totally different. It's got an ice world and a desert world, and it's not that distinctive, really. So I don't know that the world itself is worth going back to unless you go back and really just kind of retcon it. You have retcon Subcon and make it kind of a more interesting, unique place on its own merits.
Yeah, I've always kind of wondered how much ownership they consider that they have of it, like how much desire there is to kind of continue that world, really. Hmm.
I mean, it was, the Doki Doki Panic was a Miyamoto game. I mean, it was made by those people.
Yep.
Whereas, the Lost Levels was really made by kind of a junior team as a direct follow-up. I mean, it was considered an easier game for them to make because they were reusing so much stuff from the first game. Mm-hmm. So, I think it's probably not as much of an ownership question. To me, the most interesting thing that has really never been reused is the main villain, Wart. I think he's a cool looking character. He's a big cartoon sprite on the screen. And, I'm surprised that they've never really tried to bring him back. And a game like
Beyond a cameo in Link's Awakening.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that was nice. But yeah, I feel like a game like Super Mario 3D World, I think having Wart as the final boss would be like a really big, really cool surprise for fans of the series. And it would be a way to break up the usual Mario versus Bowser thing. But, Miyamoto is so stuck in his ways on the story of the Mario series and the almost like blatant and intentional disregard for it that, I don't know that he would really be interested in trying to like bring back something like that, but maybe it'd be really cool if they did. But as far as a new game in this vein, you might be best off with like Super Mario Advance, which just came out on the Virtual Console for Wii U, which is a very colorful remake of that game.
Right. So I've never played that version, but it does seem to have like they've added bells and whistles like the. Because they could rotate and scale sprites, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like it seems like there's like giant Shy Guys and things like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of little enhancements to it. the main criticism of Super Mario Advance is that the characters have little voice samples that are super irritating because they repeat so much. But I feel like, and that it's, which is a shame because that game has amazing music. I love the soundtrack to Mario 2. And a lot of those songs have been brought back and reused many times over in other Mario games. But I would love to play that game with the music on, but I don't know if there's a way to turn down the sound effects separately. If there is, I would do that. But yeah, I've thought about picking that up on the Virtual Console because I never played that version. It didn't seem that interesting back in 2001, but it kind of does now because it has been a while since I played Mario 2. It'd be cool to see them go back, but yeah, I feel like they've had so many opportunities to just use whatever they want. Maybe they don't really feel like there's that much there to go back to. I still think Wart deserves his day.
There was a point where the kind of jumping on an enemy, not killing it, and then being able to pick it up and throw it at other things was novel and fresh, but I feel like, you know, not so much today, so perhaps there's less of a point to make a sequel now.
I mean, to create a sequel, you'd be really trying to tap into that aesthetic, that kind of weirdness of you know, moving through worlds with using potions you pull out of the ground to create magic doors. You know, you're trying to get for the furor of trying to run through a stage holding a key while you're being followed by a demonic mask.
I mean, that mechanic really should come back, though.
You're really trying to tap into the elements that make that game Doki Doki Panic. Mm-hmm. Not the elements that make that game Mario. And I mean, they could certainly make a game that features those elements. They could put something out on the eShop that's just, this is, you know, some kind of weird derivative 2D platformer that just is a rehash of this stuff.
What if they made a new Doki Doki Panic?
Well, they'd have to get the rights to those characters.
Oh, because is it a manga thing?
It's a TV Tokyo thing, I think.
I think actually they're like the characters like of a market chain. Something.
No, it's definitely a TV show.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
maybe they could just call it Mario Panic. That'd be pretty cool.
Ooh, Mario Panic.
That'd be neat.
That's awesome, John.
What if they just really, really got after it on Mario Maker? What if they just kept pumping up content packs you could buy for Mario Maker?
Yep.
And one of them was Super Mario Brothers 2 themed.
Yeah,
maybe
cool.
We'll just make our own Mario 2 sequels in Mario Maker.
That would actually be pretty good.
That's a heck of an idea. Yeah.
Well, I think...
Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
I think Mario Maker is probably the major Mario game that we'll see in 2015, but... They could surprise us. I mean, we know that EAD Tokyo is working on a new Mario game, and it's from, I think, from Koizumi's comments, it sounds like it's probably a Wii U game, which I'm kind of surprised by because the 3D Land on 3DS did a lot better sales-wise. It seems like it'd be smarter for them to make a new one of those or something like it, but maybe they have other plans. Maybe they'll just make new Super Mario Brothers 3, but... Anyway, we really don't know. I mean, they are pumping out Mario games a lot more often nowadays, and the way things have been going recently, I don't really have a good feeling for what direction that series is going in. So after Mario Maker, who knows? Who knows? We'll see. Okay, so the next email comes from Kanabob from Washington. And he writes, "So, I recently downloaded Castlevania Aria of Sorrow on the Wii U eShop and have been loving it. Playing it actually reminded me how much I love these games and even went back to play through Symphony of the Night again. My question is, why don't we see these Castlevania games like we used to? Do you think Konami is testing the water by releasing all these Castlevania games on Virtual Console? I feel like Konami used to be in touch with Castlevania fans and gave us some incredible games during the GBA and DS days. But now all we have is that horrible 3DS game Mirror of Fate and two bad character action games on 360 PS3. They should just remake and modernize Simon's Quest."
Oh, God. What?
I feel like that last statement is just
kind
of a troll.
What the fuck is going on with the theme today?
Yeah.
They should just remake Castlevania Judgment.
Simon's Quest would be cool to see them try to make that into like a really good game that makes sense. Like, yeah. I think that would be super interesting, but I don't think Konami will ever do that.
Well, it's doubtful that Konami is ever going to make games again, so.
That's right. They do fashion yep. now.
Well, Metal Gear Solid 5, buddy.
Metal Gear's
about all they have.
Yep.
Hey, no, not fair. They also had a kiosk showing video of Pro Evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful.
Video of an annualized game. Fuck you, Konami. Yeah.
Now they make kiosk games. That's their new thing.
This is just video. Just video of a game that you don't get to play. The authentic Konami E3 experience.
As for, you know, why are we not seeing these games made today? I think it's pretty clear that the series has never really sold gangbusters. You know, like, it's never... I think that here, over here in North America, we have this perception that Castlevania is a big deal and that it was this huge deal on GBA and DS, and it kind of was, but the games were made on a shoestring budget, it seems, and they were always reusing sprites from older games.
Well, they also kept throwing them on the market all the time, too.
Yeah, and the development costs on new systems are a lot higher.
Oh, absolutely. They're huge.
Hmm.
So that makes it tough. And I think, you know, when you look at, you know, you've got indie games like Rogue Legacy is absolutely a successor to those Castlevania games. And I think it's a kind of game that is more easily made nowadays by independent developers who can release a game at a lower price point and more easily turn a profit. And I think Konami just looks at it and says, hey, we tried on 3DS. We made a 2D-ish game, except it was made in Europe by people who I don't think know much about Castlevania, frankly. It's too bad, you know, and that game sold horribly and they ended up re-releasing it on other systems. And I don't think it did well on those either. I don't think it's a good game from what I played of it, a couple different demos.
Right.
I never liked it. And so I never bought it, but, they took a crack at it. And, I think Castlevania will come back one day, but right now Konami just doesn't really seem to know what to do with it. And I think those console games, although I only played the first one, I thought it was pretty good. It had precious little to do with Castlevania. It was a good game, but not a good Castlevania game. And I just don't know that anyone left at Konami really cares. I think Igarashi cares, and he's now on his own. And we don't know what he's doing, but he's probably going to be making...
Bull Whip.
I think he's going to end up making something similar to those Castlevania. I mean, it won't have the name.
Rasslevania starring Hulk Hogan.
Rasslevania. That's so good, John. That's so good. That needs to... Actually, that is kind of Guacamelee.
In a little bit.
You know? It is Rasslevania. Rasslevania. Oh, man. That's too good.
Good God.
That's too good. Yeah. But I think Castlevania will come back one day. As to, I wouldn't read too much into these virtual console releases. I think all that means is, hey, there's someone at Konami who's very clearly in charge of capitalizing on catalog releases.
Oh, yeah.
And they've been consistently pretty good about it over the years. They've one of the longest and most consistent supporters of virtual console. And they release old games on all the other systems too. There's a lot of stuff on PlayStation. So they are very, very much into that. And I think they will continue to support that. But I think for them, it's just a way to pick up catalog revenue. I wouldn't take it as an indication that they're planning on anything for new games. But I am glad that they're out. And Aria of Sorrow is if you've never played that game, it is spectacular. It is so
great.
Good.
I think it's the best of the series other than Symphony of the Night.
I think it is the best Castlevania game, full stop. It's fantastic. Yeah. And I love that it's on Wii U now. That's awesome. All right. So, John, could you read the next email, por favor?
Sure. Jonathan, not me. Writes, and not
me.
You. I think that to
I'm
be
sure I believe it.
I think that to be taken seriously as an art form, games and those who discuss them seriously need to divorce from the language of visual art as much as possible. We need to have our own language to discuss our interactive art. That interaction between player and game is what speaks to us the most. That is what keeps our consoles and handhelds on in our free time. I guess if I were to funnel my thoughts into a question, it would be this. What do you guys consider the artistic qualities of games? Do you heavily consider things like graphics and music when thinking about the artistic value of a particular game? Are there other qualities that you consider? For more occasional intellectual musings, but mostly immature nonsense, check out my Nintendo-only podcast, The Nintendo Show. P.S. Guillaume is my favorite. Just saying.
Wow.
So thank you know you. It was neither one of us who wrote this.
So, yeah, right there.
But to be fair, no, that's not fair because the last time somebody on this show wrote fan mail, it was actually addressed not at the writer, to be fair.
Well, Guillaume is my favorite, at least on the weeks that he edits.
Great. That's all you see in me, an editor.
I'm using you for your body.
Yeah, well, this is how do you tackle this? I mean,
we tackle it every week.
I mean, I have a position that I can put out here. So maybe by getting it out there, it can help.
Please go ahead and put out, James.
ladies. To me, oftentimes, and I get where he's coming from. A lot of times when people talk about, oh, video games is an art form, they do tend to neglect to speak about the way the interaction works. That they do get caught up in the same kind of normative conversation we have when we talk about movies, you know, even things like plays and books and TV shows. And it does sort of remove what's most important about a video game, which is that it is a game.
Yeah, and and game creators have pushed this as well. Like, hey, my game looks just like a movie.
Absolutely. And I think that if you start to just talk about, oh, the experiences you go look at this world and stuff, it's like, yeah, that's great, but what am I doing? What am I doing to make this experience work?
Yeah, it's like your game plays like a movie too.
Right. So, I know people hate this phrase, but I just generally, the term walking simulator, those games have no resonance for me because I'm not really doing a lot.
It depends. There are cases, James, in which, I don't know how much direct experience you have, but some of them work for me, some don't. But sometimes just walking, the world reacts to how you walk through it. In other words, where you go, what order you go to see things, what angles you look at things from. And sometimes that is in itself, and it's not just walking, of course, you're also looking around, and that's much more important than the walking.
And that goes to the whole, like, you know, how do you call things, what do you define as a game? And for me, like, there needs to be some kind of real objective here. Like, can I lose? Am I doing things? Am I competing against something? Or am I just sort of exploring a world? Because that really is kind of a visual art form. I mean, if you're talking about what makes a game art versus visual art, you know, what's the difference here? That's really more like an interactive art exhibit. I mean, you go through this environment and you get to see it from different angles. And in that case, I think it's totally appropriate to use the same kind of terminology you use in the more established visual arts world, because ultimately you're having an experience. It's just it's a different form of experience. It's like, when video displays really started to make their entrance into exhibit galleries. That was,
it was a big deal.
Yeah, it really started happening in the 80s, and they were trying to figure out, do we need to use new terminology for this? And the answer ultimately was no, because you're still experiencing it the same way. You're just able to get more perspectives on it because it's not static. And I think in that, for that subset, then yeah, you can still use and primarily rely on the existing terminology. But I think when you start to make gameplay part of what makes the art work, the experience the person is having, what they are doing, I think then you do need to have your own diction, because ultimately that's what makes a game engrossing. What the player is doing, it's not just a matter of making them forget they're holding the controller. It's making them really think about what they're doing and how that impacts them.
Yeah, but that can backfire.
Sometimes the goal is not to make them forget they're holding a controller.
Right.
That's not necessarily what you always want to go for.
Yeah, it's the experience element.
That's what I'm saying. So a lot of games were like, well, I was just so enwrapped, I didn't realize I was holding the controller. Well, that may not be it, because then you may not be thinking about what you're doing. You may not be experiencing what they're having you doing in a way that really is impactful. And for it to be, for us to really think about it on the artistic sense, that needs to be part of it. Am I being impacted by what I'm doing? And if you're not thinking about what you're doing, you're probably not being impacted by it. I mean, just to be totally honest, I'll give the example I bring up a lot. And this is the game that I hate playing, but ultimately I really enjoy going through. In Fragile Dreams, you're thinking about what you're doing because everything wants to kill you and you can't fucking defend yourself. Now, that's partially because the game's combat is garbage, but it does really make the tension so incredibly high all the time that when the littlest noise happens, like, and you're not sure if it's you echoing as you're walking or something way down that hallway, it's so incredibly unnerving and just so upsetting and just mentally painful to go through. Like, you're really feeling like you're being ripped up playing that game. There's an artistic element to the gameplay there that, using the existing artistic terminology we have, doesn't work. It's just because there's nothing there. I think where you could start to see it come up is when you have these kind of interactive art exhibits. And again, that's a more recent product, and seeing it in the display space is even more recent. And then maybe you have some terminology overlap, but that's such a small field that there's not really a major contributing, not like a major voice providing the terminology we use for those. It's, you know, it's a subset of the general static art world. So we in an industry with billions and billions of dollars in revenue, it was like $662 billion, I think, last year, something like that. I mean, there is an opportunity here that we're the first, you know, major, you know, consumer grade art product in this interactive art space where there is enough voices that you could conceivably create the diction around this and it really stick. And I don't think we're doing a very good job of that right now when we talk about games as art. I would argue we probably aren't, but certainly you can do this. I just haven't seen anybody doing it particularly well, including myself.
There's a few academics that I follow on Twitter who actually study game design and try to find different ways of expressing, you know, what these games do. And, you know, some of them will try to define the distinction between, like, they'll say gameplay is not an accurate term. Let's try game feel instead.
No, then fuck explain. That. That's hippie nonsense. Get that shit out of here.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, though. I think that perhaps, like, that kind of writing.
That's art majors who should have gotten a better degree.
Probably. Well, as you don't even have to qualify that. Art majors usually should probably steer in another path. But
okay, Dad. Come on, man. I'm a poet. Come on, man.
Music history. What are you going to do? Teach other music history majors?
Wow.
I dated 3 music history majors. I'm in trouble.
I just feel like Jonathan probably would be more interested in that kind of writing than what's at, like, Polygon, where their language is really more influenced by the marketing for the games that they cover.
No, their like, language is influenced by outrage peddling. I mean, let's be honest. They are a clickbait site du jour.
There's some of that. It's very consumer level, but I think that's one end of the spectrum, and that's valid, is that, you know, as the media, as the art form matures, you have more studied, devoted, you know, media criticism. You have actual, you know, academic level study, like you're talking about, Guillaume. But also, I think the four of us are, you know, among in terms of quality, we are among the premier contributors of words about video games spoken. At least as of today.
There's just so many qualifiers in that sentence.
Yeah.
We spit a lot of game, and I think all of us, people like who do what we do, whether we write or we talk about games a lot, and even, you know, people on message boards and whatever, can try to think about their words. This is something that we do a lot, and you can hear the differences over time, I think, in how we address topics like this. But, you know, just to throw out some examples, I think of words that we use to describe video games that wouldn't be used to describe other forms of art. Things like addictive, engrossing is you know, sometimes used for books, but
things like control, like play control, you know, don't really typically use that to describe a piece of art.
Like tight. You know, or intricate, I think of in terms of the way games are designed. A lot of times I think in terms of intricacy, granularity in terms of the mechanics. This is not one I use, but I know a lot of people, like in the computer world, will sometimes use words like crunchy, in terms of like how much like, how complicated are the game systems? That, like, how much sticky. Direct... Yeah, sticky, that's a good one. Yeah,
John, that's personal.
They'll have words like verbs, the verbs of the game, the actions that you can do in that game.
Difficulty also is something that doesn't exist in any other art form, right?
Yep.
So there's a lot of terms that relate to difficulty, and I think what James talked about earlier with, like, walking simulators, which is a somewhat semi-pejorative term, maybe.
It is, but I mean, when I use that term, everybody knows what I'm talking about. So to an extent, it works.
It's shorthand, but it's a kind of game with little or no difficulty, in at least in any traditional sense. And for some people, the complete lack of difficulty means that it's not a game. I would just argue that it's just on the extreme end of games, in that, you know, all games have some difficulty because they're interactive. There's some level of challenge associated with that, whether it's intended or not by the creator, right? People are able or not able to experience that art, which is, you know, not really, there's a degree of difficulty maybe associated with books or movies in terms of the level of sophistication that you have to have.
If you talk with, like, I know music pretty well. If I talk to somebody who's at that next level, fuck, I'm blown out of the water, and I can't appreciate what they're experiencing the same way.
Well, yeah, but also I think what you see in a lot of cases in other art forms is that really good examples, or like really celebrated examples of different art forms, often work on multiple levels, right? Mm-hmm. So it's something that you can come into with no prior knowledge and no preparation and appreciate on some visceral level, something that just appeals to your human nature, something that is just immediately accessible, and you go, oh my gosh, this is great. And then also you can break it down and really study it in a very discreet way. And it also is really interesting on that level. And I think games are getting to the point. I think there are kind of occasional examples of that working. I mentioned Chrono Trigger, which I think is one of my favorite examples of a game that does that. Super Metroid as well. But I think as we go forward, I'm mostly interested in games that do that. You know, a game that, like, is sort of immediately appealing on some base level, but also as you dig into it, it becomes increasingly satisfying the more you devote to it and the more that you think about it and the more that you play it.
There are games that are on the other extreme end of difficulty. Things like, when I hear people talk about character action games who play it at the highest of high levels, like they're describing.
That's a really bad term, by the way. I know it's common, but I hate that phrase. Character. I like Super Mario Brothers is a character action game. I mean, that just doesn't mean
anything. It is a term that has a meaning that I use it in the context of this conversation with our audience, and they know what I mean.
I hope they do. Like, I wonder, I think sometimes we do, I think jargon can be bad also, in that it can prevent people from understanding you, right? So character action game is just something that the average person on the street would have no idea.
I've always tried to describe it when I've said that.
I don't think it's necessary. I think that term has enough cultural resonance with our audience that they know
I hope means. So, but in case someone is left in the cold, James is referring to stuff like Bayonetta, for instance.
Yeah, okay. I don't know. I've always wondered if we should start breaking games down by the type of kind of challenge that they offer. Like, what's the core challenge that you're trying to do? Like, what are you doing in Tetris versus, you know, something like a character action game or something like that? Like, there's always...
Because those games, I mean, there's a very specific, you know, gameplay style that, if you're using that term as it has become adopted, like, that is referring to a very specific kind. That is basically referring to Devil May Cry and its descendants.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what you're looking at.
Well, yeah. It's really what you're doing. You're using it as a genre, but I think the listener's question here really goes beyond genre as to talking about more the discrete elements that different genres use in different groupings, and they twist and they subvert.
I'm just pulling those games out as an example to describe something, a kind of a concept of art that exists solely within the confines of interactive experiences. In working on separate levels, there is the intro to that game, the visual appeal, you know, story, plot, settings, characters, music, all that stuff. And to your point, that's very quick in. And Bayonetta, that's from, you know, I just started playing it. That's a good example. It's right in there. You're experiencing the stuff. But there's that second level where, you sort of understand the almost kind of poetry of moving these combos against one another and just flowing all this stuff together that maybe you have to be super experienced to get at, but in a way it's kind of verse because you understand, you know, there's sort of a rhythmic beat pattern to it. You know, it has its own kind of, to borrow a term from theater, it's almost pentameter of just understanding how these things go together and how each game lets you experiment with those and how they build their systems. People who are super deep into those games, like they can have incredibly in-depth conversations about, you know, one game's cadence versus another game's cadence and how these things work, you know, against one another, how the people who made this game experimented and designed. So I think there are multiple levels of sort of the artistry there that maybe we in this group may not get, but there are people who get it.
Well, you can certainly evaluate the depth of experience that is possible, the potential,
sure,
of that,
right? Sure, but I don't know that we can have but if to Johnny's point of like games that work on multiple levels, I don't know that we can have, when it comes to games like Bayonetta, we're the average middle class Londoner sitting on the ground laughing about fart jokes. Whereas our betters at these games are up in the bleachers laughing about the political ramifications of what's actually happening on the play.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Those games work on levels that I can't appreciate. And I'm not interested in spending the time to get into them, but that is still a game that I intend to play through and enjoy.
But you could say for a film, a director might be able to appreciate a film. You might watch the same film with the director, and the director could appreciate different things.
Absolutely.
Theoretically appreciate it more than you do because he's more, you know, he's deeper into the craft of actually making movies.
Yeah, and appreciating how things are made is different from appreciating them, right?
Right.
So that's one reason that I don't really like to talk about game development that much. But and you see this a lot in like enthusiast media, is that people like to talk about how the game was made, or they use a lot of kind of catchphrases and cliches about game development and
feedback
and what
loops
went into,
and, you know, stuff like that.
Things relating to maybe why certain things are the way that they are in games. And I really try to avoid that stuff because, number one, I really don't know anything about it. I might think that I do, but I'm sure people who actually make games would again laugh at my description of how games are actually made. And number two, I think talking about game development and the things that go in there, it's a fascinating topic unto itself. But it has little to do with what I'm more interested in, which is criticism of the final thing, mm-hmm, right?
Yep.
So it's like movies. Like I can review a movie without talking about how the movie was made or without knowing anything about how the movie was made.
Yeah, it's like, do you really care how they make the CGI monsters? No. You know, that doesn't have anything to do with your experience watching the movie or enjoying it.
There are instances where that becomes informative, where when you look at how something was made and you can critique it at an artistic standpoint.
But are you critiquing it as a product as opposed to an artistic experience at that point?
I don't know. I mean, it's at some point you're kind of splitting hairs. I mean, to a certain community, that the idea of critiquing anything that is an artistic medium as a product would be anathema to them. Like you should be critiquing it only on its artistic value. So I think it's going to be depending on the audience you're talking to, how they perceive it more than what you feel like you're doing. It's hard though, because to Johnny's point, if you don't know how this stuff works, it can be difficult. I mean, we can look at some stuff and say, you know, at a high level, like, oh yeah, this is, you know, this is what they did when they made this game. To give the example, shoot, I'm trying to remember the name of the engine now. There's like an engine, I can't remember what it was. Every time a game was made in it, you could look at it and go, yep, there it is.
Well, Unreal Engine.
Yeah, Unreal 3, yeah. But it's like that is something that an enthusiast could figure out. You don't necessarily have to be a developer. But it's hard.
Well, you don't even have to know the name of that engine, though. You can just look at all these games coming out and say, I don't want to play these games, or I do want to play these games because they remind me of each other so much.
This looks curiously like Gears of War.
It's interesting that to know why that is the case, but it doesn't really change the nature of the fact that these games all have a very similar visual style.
They all screen tear exactly the same way.
Yes. Well, and that's another aspect that is really easy to get bogged down into when you talk about video games, is that they are one of the few art forms that is so dependent on the technical aspects, much more so, I think, than others. And and there's even a, we talked about, like, with emulation, that there was the question on the telethon about you know, whether bugs should be fixed on Virtual Console. I mean, there's even different ways that different people will play a game, whether you pirate it or whether you play it on a portable or on a console or different kinds of TVs even, they can change your experience in a way that's not always the case with other art forms, especially right. Anything that you go to a museum to see, for instance, or you can only hear in a concert. That is the person making the art has much more control over how you will experience it. And in video games, there's only so much you can do at the coding level, before you print, you know, you print an executable and you send it out there, and then people are going to play it on whatever machines they have.
Well, yeah. I mean, it goes to Miyamoto's comment about hating to make games for TVs because he doesn't know what you have.
Yeah. Yeah. And I sympathize with that. I think it's a really interesting conundrum that video games deal with that a lot of other kinds of artwork.
But I mean, from a mechanical standpoint, I write software for a living. I deal with that shit, and it sure as hell isn't artistic. It's just the same considerations of, all right, what am I dealing with? What kind of environment is this being used in?
Yeah, and a lot of times when you write software, you want it to be portable. You want it to be
absolutely
available to different people in different forms. But that's a utilitarian thing.
It's the weird intersect between, but I mean, even the same concerns, like, how do I make this display not knowing what their display is? It's the weird intersect between engineering and art that this medium has. Modern film has it because of the sheer preponderance of special effects, CG and stuff like that. But it's an intersect in that every element of it is directly tied back into that same engineering. That's probably the biggest reason why this particular art needs its own terminology, because you can't divorce the two and talk about one without talking about the other. They both.
It's absolutely true in the sense that, you know, video games, of course, have artwork, and I mean, they have, you know, illustrations, and they have music, and they have these things that are produced by people who may know nothing about software engineering or computer programming, but all of those elements have to be filtered through the code in order to be integrated into the game. So at some point, all that stuff has to come down, and ultimately the game is code. It right. has all that other stuff in it, but the game itself, the thing that you're buying, is just a bunch of zeros and ones. And so it has to go through all these different people to get there. Yeah, I mean, the complexity of the medium makes it difficult to talk about. But like I said, I mean, I think this is something we struggle with every single week, and we find ways to do it. Maybe sometimes it's the path of least resistance, but one thing I think about a lot, and I'm sure you guys do too, is, you know, when you're talking about a game, how do you describe it? How do you talk about it in a way that people will understand you? Because that's kind of our job. That's why we're here. And sometimes it's very difficult to do. I think you can probably hear a struggle with it a lot of times.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, there's plenty of room for debate. But I mean, what we, you know, it's like any other language. It will develop organically. And you can either contribute to it, or you can try to degrade it and bring it down. And I hope people will try to be more clear and more descriptive when they talk about games, because it's so easy to jump into, like, lazy lingo, or, you know, inside jokes and things like that. And that's ultimately not productive. You know, we should try to find ways to introduce more people to the concept of games and what makes them great, and what ways are they interactive, and how does one game's interactivity differ from another game's. And if I need to be able to describe that to my parents and to, you know, my coworkers and my friends. And so I'm always looking for ways to do that better.
Mm-hmm. I will say, though, don't think that, even though this industry is still very new, it's the only artistic expression that struggles with this stuff.
Go read
Soviet era reviews of music, because it's so remarkable that they had to reinvent their entire language for discussing music to fit into the Politburo's view of how music should be executed. that you see these situations where there's a piece that's so remarkably clearly satirical about how the Soviet Union operates, but the Politburo influenced review has to kind of work these terms to make it sound super patriotic. And they're working around existing artistic norms. It is a remarkably informative experience that makes you wonder why the hell Dmitri Shostakovich wasn't just shot in the head at some point. Because I feel like they probably just wanted to kill him so they don't have to write about him anymore.
You know, it's just it's a very young medium, and I mean, we're going to be grappling with this for some time. But I mean, it's bound to get sorted out because, you know, it's like if you look historically, every kind of art medium has built on what's come before it and combined it, right? Like, you know, you had music and then you had, you know, film combined music and photography, and now this combines kind of everything. So it'll get sorted out. It's just a matter of time. But I think that you're going to see probably some people, like a couple of figures, come out as like the big critics.
I think you only need really two words, cool and annoying. This game did this thing. It was cool. And that thing was annoying. A mixed bag,
John,
yes.
I have one critique of your argument.
Here we go.
Have you fucking seen television these days? Hey, shit figured out over there.
yeah, but there's a lot of stuff that they're not looking at as art either.
All right. Well, let's wrap up this segment talking about a specific game with this final email. And this has a long – there's a dozen short questions here. Guillaume, why don't you just read the intro here, and then we'll – pick out questions that we want to talk about.
Sure. Adolf Vega writes, I, for one, am very excited for the re-release of Majora's Mask for 3DS, but Nintendo left out so many questions unresolved regarding this game. And there's a list of 12 questions. So,
yeah, so many.
Apparently they did leave out so many questions.
So many.
Mm-hmm.
12 specifically.
So I can take the low-hanging fruit here. Number one, is Majora's Mask exclusive to new 3DS? Hell no.
No.
But it will probably, and Mr. Aonuma, who, this was his first game as director in the Zelda series. This was where he really took over from Miyamoto,
right,
was with Majora's Mask. So this game is very special to him. I'm sure he's heavily involved in the remake. But he has hinted that there may be some expanded features for the
sure
new 3DS.
Which would be...
Right.
Fitting, because this game was the memory pack using Zelda games.
I guess there's a history of that.
Yes.
Yeah. So we don't know what that would be yet. You can probably imagine a few things, but.
And definitely there will, if there, every Nintendo game going forward will almost certainly have a performance improvements on new 3DS.
Yeah.
Existing games will struggle with it because the architecture is different. But if Nintendo is developing a new game, they are accounting for that new architecture.
And just to recap, the only known exclusive game to that new system is the Xenoblade.
God fucking damn it, Nintendo.
That is the only one we know of.
Yep. Right.
But there will be more to come, of
that
course.
Officially only exists in one region right now.
Yep, that's Japan only. But so is new 3DS for now.
No,
so,
no, it's not, because it's in Australia.
Japan and New Zealand and Australia, yep. All right, guys, what do you think? Some of these other questions, just throw them out there.
Let's just rapid fire them.
How will the game be changed to make it more portable friendly regarding saving? Well,
I mean, the game always had a rapid suspend feature. It was just you had to go to an owl to do it. They probably just make it so you can rapid suspend. Or you could just close the lid on your 3DS.
You can do that, but maybe they add just put the owl in a menu that you can access anytime.
Right.
Maybe.
I would like that.
I mean, you could. I think there was a song that you could play
to
take
you
the
closest.
Back.
You could pick what owl you go to.
Yeah, yeah. So you could always do that and then save whichever one you end up at. But that would, of course, would remove you from whatever situation you were in. So that could screw up your timing on a quest, or it could, you know, make you lose progress in a dungeon.
But in that case, you can just close the 3DS. If it's, and you know, if it's a super hyper concern right now, just flip it closed and come back later.
Most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, this game overall was fairly pick-up-and-play friendly in that, you know, you had the bomber's notebook telling you where you needed to be. The owl statues let you kind of quick save wherever you wanted to be at that moment in time. If you screwed up, just, or if you missed time on something, just roll back and go and have another go at it.
Mm-hmm.
Amiibo support. I'm going to say yes, probably. I'm going to say when he says the new 3DS features, that's what he's talking about.
Hmm.
Probably not deep support, probably like, hey, if you tap the Link statue on this, you get an item or something silly. But I think Nintendo's probably going to throw it at pretty much everything, even if it's just a minor sport. I mean, they're going in and patching it into Mario Kart 8 and Hyrule Warriors. I'm pretty sure they're going to worry about it on what is, at the moment at least, their biggest announced 3DS game of next year. I mean, it is.
By biggest, it will probably have the most sales, I'll say.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Of anything that we know of, yeah.
Yeah. So I would think they would put it in there.
I think creatively, Codename Steam is a bigger deal.
Yeah, I'm referring exclusively to their bottom line.
Sure.
It is the biggest game they have announced for next year.
Speaking of bottom line, I think there'll be faceplates and themes to bring in that extra Skrilla.
Oh, absolutely there will be. And a puzzle. Mm-hmm. But that won't be money, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there will definitely be a theme. There will definitely be faceplates.
A special edition system. I don't know about that.
I think yes.
I think a
new 3DS bundle, if the new 3DS is ready by then.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. my timing. Yeah, timing is my big question there.
In Japan, definitely. There will be a new 3DS that has the faceplates that John is anticipating.
Yeah, absolutely. Drooling over those faceplates.
Because the thing is, the faceplates, if they're just doing the regular new 3DS, that means they don't have to necessarily manufacture a whole new system to do special editions. They just throw in a limited edition faceplate in the box, and they're good to go.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That bottom line got saved.
Yep.
There's a question about sticking with the 3-day setup, and yes, absolutely.
You ruin that game if you remove it.
Yeah, they would not muck with it. That would require major rework to that game.
I mean, I think you'd lose what makes that game special.
Yep.
96 hours remaining just doesn't have the right ring to it.
You know, there could be... I wonder... You know, one thing that would seems like it would be relatively easy to add would be more songs. And the songs on the Ocarina are how you control time in this game. So at first, you can only reset back to day zero, basically. But later on, you learn songs that let you slow down time, or you can also fast forward to the next 12-hour mark. You know, whether it's basically, I think it's noon or midnight, are your options there. And one thing I found, especially when I was trying to complete a lot of the quests, is that skipping forward 12 hours really was too big of a jump in a lot of cases. And for some of the more complicated quests, it would have been nice to maybe select how far forward I skipped. So I could see them maybe modifying that song or adding additional songs that give you more control over the flow of time. And maybe it's something you don't unlock until late in the game when that's more of a concern. But as far as usability, it would make some of those quests way less annoying, because there's definitely quests where it feels like you just have to set the controller down and wait 20 minutes for somebody to show up. And if you skip, you'll go too far. But the other thing is, when you set the controller down or the system down and just wait around, you end up going off to make a sandwich. And when you come back, you realize, oops, too long. So being able to have a little more direct control over that would be a big help. And I could see them doing that.
I'm going to combine two, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Will the Fierce Deity Mask be expanded upon so you can use it in more areas, and a new dungeon or extended area on the final area? The Fierce Deity Mask and the final area... So the final area for this game is... I mean, I don't want to spoil it, but it's very different from any other Zelda game.
It's incredible.
Yeah, I think touching that beyond just making it look nice ruins the message that game is putting out there. Mm-hmm. How this happened. I mean, if we're talking about as an artistic experience, that is a situation where you go into it, if you've just come off of Ocarina of Time, expecting this slog through this heavily fortified dungeon, and instead you're met with this. You're met with, you know, just Elysian Fields. It's crazy. And you just have to kind of, you know, figure out what's going on there. But the Fierce Deity Mask is sort of the payoff for all the work you did. It's this thing that you get at the end. I don't know that taking it out works, though. I mean, it almost doesn't work just to have it. I mean, it's so game breaking that it's kind of ridiculous.
It is game breaking, but you can only use it against the final boss, and most players probably never got it, because the Fierce Deity Mask, the way you get it is you have to get every mask in the game, which is very time consuming. It means I think there's 30 of them, and almost all of them you get by completing side quests, and some of these are very complex. The wedding one in particular is a nightmare to try to finish, and it's very difficult.
But that one does get you like 3 or 4 masks through the course of it.
Yeah, true. And story wise, it's very satisfying. It's one of those things. I'm hoping they tighten up the design of that quest a little bit, make it a little bit easier to do. But the Fierce Deity mask is very hard to get. And you have to be a real completionist. But once you get it, you at the end of the game, you basically trade in all the masks you've collected, and you get this one in exchange. And you can only put it on in the very final boss battle. But it turns you into this crazy ghost ninja version of Link that makes the final boss super easy. And
I mean, Link becomes so with all these masks, he's taking on a persona. The persona he's taking on this one is a literal god.
Mm-hmm.
And you fucking feel like God when you're playing with it.
Yeah, and it is a really, really cool part of the game, and I would actually really love to see them add on like an extra post-game dungeon or something, or a mode or something like that where you could spend more time with it, because it takes so much effort to get that thing, and then you use it in a boss battle that's over in 3 minutes. Because it's so easy.
It's not over. It's over faster than
so it's satisfying that it makes you feel super powerful, but also it's kind of a letdown because you barely get to use it at all. And I would really like to see them do something about
but
that.
But my concern with that mask is that it's so horrifyingly powerful that it would be hard to build anything around it. Sure. I mean, the sheer magnitude of strength that he has once he puts that mask on is unbelievable.
Well, maybe they give you a dungeon type scenario that's not combat dependent, so it's
but then the mask doesn't really do anything. I mean,
well, but they could add some mobility upgrades to it or some puzzle solving aspects to it.
Talking about masks that don't get used, I'd almost rather them find a way to use the stone mask more or the giant mask. I mean, that mask is literally used in one boss battle, and it is a mask that you have to go through a level to get to. And it is one of the most satisfying and also N64 destroying things in the Zelda franchise. Because you put that mask on and Link turns into a giant and he is fighting other giants. So
it's Godzilla mode, basically.
Yeah, but like the N64 just can't handle it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just dying. So more opportunities to use that thing. Even if it's just like a mini, so like they put in a boss rush mode on the Ocarina of Time remake. I mean, they could put something in with like the giant's mask where you just go all kaiju battle on there.
That'd be fun.
I mean, it's such a dumb mask that it, really getting the opportunity to use it more would be enjoyable.
There's a lot of the masks that are extremely situational that I would love to see them add some additional opportunities to really make use of.
I do like that every mask does something, though. I mean, granted, yeah. Some of the all-night mask is really only useful to stay up through the old woman stories. But it's such a ridiculous mask that I'd sometimes ran around with it on anyway and was perfectly satisfied to do that. it's so, I mean, Link looks horrified while he's wearing it. It's beautiful. Shoot, there's one more that caught my eye. Oh.
Why did it take nearly 3 years?
Yeah, because they weren't working on it. Because they weren't working on it. It wasn't a big...
They said that they were.
It wasn't their leading priority.
It wasn't Onuma's for sure, because he had to worry about Link Between Worlds and the Wii U game.
Maybe they kind of got stuck
for a while.
It was Gretzo, right? That made these?
Yeah.
I mean, they did Wii Fit U in the middle of that.
Yeah, probably got lost in the mix when they reshuffled everybody to get like Pikmin done and all that kind of stuff.
Gretzo is its own company. They do other stuff. So
yeah,
they may have had some people doing planning work on it and then just handed it off when it was ready.
Yeah, maybe it wasn't in full-blown development until more recently. But also say, I mean, Majora's Mask is a very complicated game, and I think in a lot of ways it makes sense to me that this might be harder to remake than Ocarina.
And they've done sort of – I mean, they've gone back through and worked on Ocarina in the past a couple times at this point, because they did the Master Quest – which itself was sort of a pickup of something they had worked on for the DD. I mean, they've done stuff with that game in the past, where this is really their first opportunity at doing another pass at this game.
Yeah, I mean, it was emulated on a GameCube disc, but real badly. That is not the way to play this game.
And that's not really doing something with it. That's just dumping it onto an emulator and throwing it on a GameCube disc.
They did a better job on Virtual Console, but still, the Majora's Mask is such an ambitious N64 game that really kind of broke that system in some ways, as James described. And also, I bet the code for this game is a complete mess because it was made in such a hurry and is like reusing, but also like modifying so much of Ocarina of Time. I bet it was quite a challenge to dig through this. And
I would guess the Ocarina of Time remake, I don't want to say it was probably rushed, but it was probably an express project that they probably weren't eager to do again. Because remember, we saw that game, the E3 07, 08, 09? The one where they showed the 3DS the first time. It had been 08.
Yeah, 08.
Yeah, and at the end of the round table, they're like, oh, and we've got this one more thing. And it was just the opening video on a 3DS. So that game basically existed as an opening video, and then was a game of like a year in... No, because Neil had it at the next E3 because he had the review copy. That game was probably a rush job.
Well, but and I haven't really played the 3DS remake of that, but I've heard so many great things about it. I'm really excited to see them give the same touch to a game that I might like even more.
Majora's it's a really Mask. Solid. Oh, I mean, I love Majora's Mask. It's I have a huge really fondness solid for remake.
It. So, but it's as we discovered in Retroactive not too long ago, it's kind of hard to go back to. So,
I mean, part of it is just because the N64 can't handle it. I mean, some of those character models, you can see where they were cutting polygons because the N64 is dying.
Yeah. And it's a dark, grainy game that just doesn't look that great on modern TVs. I'm excited for them to go back and really give this the premier treatment that I think the game really does deserve.
Maybe I'll like it this time.
Maybe you will. I'm sure that's foremost in their minds, is that they know there's a lot of people who never could get into it for whatever reason. And
yeah,
I'm sure they're going to try to get all of you guys.
Yeah, I mean, I'm among them. I've always had a hard time playing through all this one all the way.
There is a Nintendo World Report staff member that has never gotten the Deku mask off.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not me either.
And that is a part of the game
that
really needs a lot of work. The beginning of that game, I think, is rough.
Yeah, it's boring as hell.
Well, it's not even that it's boring. It's that if you don't catch everything the game is telling you, like it tells you need to go to this place, but if you don't do that, you may get stuck and you may run out of time.
Mm-hmm. It's not unusual to play those first 3 days two or three times before you get everything right. And actually get the Ocarina and get the mask off. And nobody really wants to play through the opening of a game two or three times before they get to play the rest of it.
Yep.
So I'm sure that is receiving a ton of attention in this remake process. As it should, really. All right, guys. Well, that's going to wrap up our show. Thank you, everyone, for listening. The email address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And before we go, I do want to let everybody know... lots of reviews going up and videos going up on our website this time of year.
And video reviews.
Of course, video reviews, yeah. So subscribe to NWR TV on YouTube, and every day go check out NintendoWorldReport.com because this is our busiest season, this and E3. And this is definitely a time when you want to be keeping a close eye on the website. And there's also probably going to be some news. You know, Nintendo likes to announce big news right at the end of the year a lot of times, after Black Friday. So I wouldn't be surprised to see another Nintendo Direct in December or some other way of releasing a bunch of stuff. So check that out as well. But anyway, we love talking to you. We hope you enjoyed listening to it. And we'll do it again very soon, next week. And we'll talk about Smash Brothers then. So enjoy it, and see you next time.
Later.
Bye.
Bye.